Hey, Eric here. Before we start this episode, Lara and I wanted to mention that we've recently launched a newsletter. If you're looking for some career inspiration in your inbox, head over to howigotherepodcast.com. In the newsletter, we share behind-the-scenes thoughts about our episodes and feature written stories on how others have figured out their own career journeys and share their advice. If you've enjoyed the podcast and are craving for more honest and inspiring career content, you should definitely sign up at howigotherepodcast.com. We've got a bunch of subscribers so far, and you're not going to want to miss out. Without further ado, here's the show. Thanks for listening. This is How I Got Here, a podcast where we interview professionals about how they navigated the twists and turns of their careers. We hope these conversations can help you figure out where you want to go and how you'll get there.
We're your hosts. I'm Lara Mitra.
And I'm Eric Eliason.
In each episode, we'll first give you a quick intro about who we're speaking with. Then we'll get into the interview. And lastly, we'll each share our biggest takeaways from the conversation.
Today, we have the immense pleasure of interviewing Steve Cook, Executive Managing Director at LFM Capital. On this episode, you'll hear how Steve moved from the military into manufacturing and then finally into private equity. Steve is honest and humble and really willing to get into the details about how he was feeling and how he navigated his own career. After his time being a pilot for the Navy, Steve was looking to be in real air, an analogy you'll hear about in the episode that I find to be really illuminating. His focus was to drive value in the real world, not just working through a bureaucracy. He found this in a role as a leader in charge of Dell Computer's manufacturing arm out of Tennessee. And he quickly dedicated more and more of his time and energy towards this endeavor and his career. And then a natural disaster hit, and it fundamentally shifted how he approached his work and his life. We'll be right back after the break.
Yeah, hi, this is Steve Cook. I am currently the managing partner for LFM Capital. I'm really excited to have an opportunity to spend some time with you guys today.
So maybe we can start actually at the Naval Academy. What drew you to initially join the service?
A big part of it was just financial. My dad owned his own business, and that was really up and down. And my sister is 2 years older than me. I think they had to pull her out of BU for a semester for financial reasons. And it was just wasn't hard for me to do the math that if they were struggling to get one through college, getting two through college was probably going to be that much harder. So I set in my mind when I was a sophomore in high school to go to the Naval Academy, or maybe sophomore junior. I worked for my best friend's dad doing stonemasonry work in the summer, and shared with him during the summer that I kind of had this dream. And he said, there is no way you will ever get into a service academy. They're looking for captains of varsity sports, and you know, there's just no way. And that actually motivated me in a huge way to prove him wrong. And it just became kind of my life mission.
And then you eventually became a naval flight officer, right? And could you tell us about what that experience was like? And at the time, did you think that you could do it forever?
I loved my time in the Navy. I mean, absolutely loved it. I hated the separation from my wife. And my first child was born a year before I got out of the Navy. And I just couldn't imagine leaving her for 6 months at a time. 6 month deployments on an aircraft carrier. I absolutely loved the flying and I loved the people I was working with, but I hated the separation from loved ones. And that was really what drove me to get out.
So it sounds like leaving the Navy after 7 years, you talked about how you were going into business school, unsure of what you wanted to do next. How did grad school help clarify your goals and what you wanted to do with your career?
What changed my mind was my internship. So as part of the LGO program, you do a 6.5 month internship. Going into my internship, I still thought I want to go work at like McDonnell Douglas and work on the F-18. And so I really kind of pulled together an internship with ITT Night Vision, which wasn't even a partner with the program at the time. So it was kind of a special circumstance. I was a night vision goggle instructor in the Navy. We flew with night vision goggles all the time. So I thought this was a perfect internship. And when I got on that internship, I was leading a really cool project. We were designing the first night vision scope for the SEALs, which would allow them, you know, really long range shots at night, or all snipers, but predominantly the SEALs. But through that project, I got really frustrated with the pace of working in a government project. And I'll never forget, it was a pretty small team. You know, the whole company, that division of ITT was probably only a few hundred people. But one night I was there late and I was just complaining to one of the other engineers that was, you know, probably in his late 50s or 60s about just the bureaucracy and the pace and everything. And he said, you know, Steve, if you're going to survive in the defense industry, you just need to figure out how to build the price of that frustration into your quote. And I said, you know, I'm a taxpayer. I hate that solution. And so I left that internship and said, there is no way I'm going to work in the defense industry.
So Steve, up until this point, it seems like you had really pursued things that you were passionate about or really interested in. And then after your time at, you know, working in a kind of government contract, you were frustrated with the bureaucracy. So I guess when you were going to Dell, what were you looking for in that experience? Were you still passionate about what Dell was offering, or were you looking more for kind of a different experience?
Dude, when I was in the Navy, I loved being up on deck on the aircraft carrier. It was very dangerous there, but I called it kind of real air, like the salt air, planes moving around, you know, launching off the aircraft carrier, landing back on the aircraft carrier. But below decks, like there was all these meetings and conference rooms, and I called that fake air. Like I wanted to get out of the fake air as quickly as possible and get into the real air. And I think, you know, at a company like Dell, to me, like manufacturing was the real air. Like you're making a product that the customers ordered, you're building it to the specifications, you know, they ordered as a build to order company, a direct sales model. And manufacturing and supply chain were just a big, big part of Dell's success back then.
So it sounds like at that point you were so happy and you loved your job. And could you see yourself there forever? You know, could that have been the end game?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think for the first 5 or 6 years, I thought I would spend my entire career at Dell. I think to this day, I have the record for promoting from what they call kind of a C2 level up to a D3 level, which is their kind of executive level. And, you know, I was getting a lot of exposure to Michael Dell, to Kevin Rollins, to really kind of all the senior executives in the company. And we were doing some really neat things. It was kind of like a big startup, very high energy culture, very fast clock speed. You know, we had 18,000 employees when I got there. When I left 11 years later, we had 80,000. At that point, it felt, you know, more bureaucratic and slow moving and more political. And so really what changed for me was that kind of feeling of more non-value added time dedicated to like politics and bureaucracy, the stuff that I didn't like at ITT Night Vision. I didn't feel that at all when I got there. You know, the first 5 or 6 years we were moving, my plant won Industry Week's best week, you know, best plant in the world. So that was an absolute blast.
Wow. Well, Steve, it sounds like you had a lot of successes while at Dell, and it also sounds like you must have worked really hard to achieve a lot of those things. I'm interested to see because, you know, it sounded like you had part of the reason why you had left the military was to make sure that you had time with your family. So how did you balance like working really hard at your job, but also making room for, you know, quality time with friends and family and hobbies and things like that?
You know, the specific reason I got out of the Navy was to not be away for 6 months at a time. And I think, you know, I kind of got lured into just working more and more hours. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure you've heard that analogy about how you boil a frog.
Right.
Apparently it's a wives' tale. It's not true. But the analogy is that you turn the water up a little bit at a time and they don't ever notice that they're in boiling water. I would say, you know, I got to a point in my career at Dell where I was in boiling water and didn't realize it. And I was in face-to-face meetings from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m., literally even lunch. So my administrative assistant started scheduling bathroom breaks. You know trouble when your administrative assistant has to schedule bathroom breaks. But then I would, you know, get home, have dinner with my family, help my wife put the children to sleep, And then I'd lay on the couch and do email for 3 or 4 hours. I would also do, you know, probably 6 or 7 hours of email on Saturday, another 3 or 4 hours of email on Sunday. And so I think I was due for a pretty good wake up call.
What was that wake up call for you?
I was sitting in a conference room having a face-to-face meeting with some of my leaders at Dell. And on the phone was the vice president of HR for all of operations. I was a director at the time, so he outranked me. And at the time, I carried 2 cell phones. One was kind of my personal cell phone, and one was my professional cell phone. And I got a phone call on my personal cell phone. It was from one of our children's teachers. So I stepped out of the meeting to take the call because it was just rare that my personal cell phone would ring. And she said, "I'm freaking out. Tornadoes came through the areas, and I think a tornado might have hit your house, and I can't get hold of Shannon, my wife." And I said, "Connie, there's no way, you know, that a tornado hit my house. You know, I'm sure everything's okay." And so I went back into the meeting and I said, "Boy, that was a really odd call." And the VP of HR said, "You know, you really should go home." And I said, no, I'm sure it's nothing. And, you know, let's just finish the meeting." And he said, "No, you really should go home." And I said, "No, let's finish the meeting." He goes, "You don't understand what I'm saying. I outrank you. You should go home." And I kind of walked the hall for about 5 minutes, like, not sure, should I leave? Should I go? And then all of a sudden my personal cell phone had a voicemail, but it had never rung, which was really weird. And my wife had left me a voicemail saying, "Jackson and I are alive, but we have no earthly possessions. Come home as quickly as you can." And that was her entire message. I was like, wow, I need to go home. And I got kind of on the other side. It was a pretty thin lake where I live. On the other side of that water, but I couldn't get to our house. There were downed trees and power lines. It was really like something out of a movie with people walking around with blood pouring out of their head and stuff. And I saw pieces of my kids' playscape on, like, this is like a mile or two from our house. And I was like, wow, this is really going to be bad.
Oh, thank goodness you had heard from your family that they were already safe. What had happened to them during the storm?
They barely survived. The whole house was destroyed. Our house was one of, like, really the only house in our neighborhood that had a storm shelter. In fact, we used to joke about it with the people that built the house. But my wife got into that storm shelter literally with a second or two to spare, with windows smashing as she ran through the house carrying our 4-year-old. She couldn't find him for a little while. He was out on the front steps watching our neighbor's house get torn down. And she ran with him like a football. She's actually in really good shape. And windows were smashing everywhere she ran. And they didn't have a scratch. It was just a total miracle.
Wow, Steve, that really is a miracle. But I'm wondering, it sounds like such a big change. How did you start to put the pieces back together?
Tennessee is truly the volunteer state. Incredible people I'd never met, like, showed up and tried to help my family start salvaging what could be salvaged. The entire, like, Dell team came the next day. They rented trucks. They stole Dell boxes and Dell tape, literally, like, illegally took them out of the factory. And they packed up everything that could be salvaged, you know, by, like, noon the next day, which was just an incredible thing. And I had not eaten from noon on, like, Friday. This was a Saturday that they all came to my house, till, you know, like, noon on Saturday. And these Cub Scouts came up to the front of our house and said, you know, "Sir, are you hungry?" And I'll never forget it. I was starving. I didn't even know it. And they had made peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. And it's like the best food I've ever had in my life. And it just, all of a sudden, the light bulb went on. Like, this is why you do volunteer work. You know, until the Red Cross is at your door helping you and giving you food, you don't realize, like, how important it is to support organizations like that, that are helping people that are really, you know, at a disadvantage. the most vulnerable people are the people that need that kind of help. But unless you're vulnerable, you don't realize that. But honestly, I mean, this is a crazy thing to say, but in hindsight, it's one of the top five things that's ever happened to me in my life. It was such a wake-up call to me about what's really important and how I want to treat people that report to me or that are in my organizations. I mean, I'm very spiritual. God basically saying, you know, I almost took everything from you. You know, your wife and child survived. It was, like I said, a big wake-up call. And I would say my leadership style changed quite a bit as a result of that.
Wow, I'm really sorry that you had to go through that experience. And I look up to your ability to reframe it as one of the best things that's happened to you. And I'm curious what you mean when you say that your leadership style changed after this experience.
I would say the hours that I work personally are definitely more realistic. I started coaching my son's football team, and I just said, I'm leaving work, you know, at 4 o'clock. And it doesn't mean I don't, you know, I'm not dedicated to you guys. And it doesn't mean I'm not as focused on our team being successful, but you know, this is important for me at this phase of my life. I really started pouring more into relationships with my team. I'll give you a concrete example. Austin had always had like a day where they basically shut down all manufacturing and everyone went to San Antonio to Six Flags. And for a manufacturing person that makes, you know, 12 bucks an hour, that was literally like their family vacation for the year. And Nashville had never had that. And I just put my foot down and said, you know, we're doing it. We're going to carve out the budget. We're going to find a way to take a day off. And it was wildly popular. And you know, I think really built a lot of loyalty to the team. I wouldn't say that I, you know, gave up on getting results. I mean, we still had a lot of success as a team, but I would say the how was quite different. And a lot more focus on spending time on the manufacturing floor, on building relationships with people outside of work, on trying to ensure that my team had a work-life balance, on pushing back against unreasonable demands, and just trying to find the right balance, you know, between business results and people, you know, being cared for, and trying to thread that needle when it was difficult to find that balance.
Wow. And did you, this sounds like such a traumatic experience that obviously affected a lot of change on you. When you switched your priorities and kind of, you know, took a different leadership approach, were your peers and your bosses and your direct reports, were they surprised? Like, how did they help you or challenge you through that change?
I was pretty transparent with people with how this had changed me. And it's not, it wasn't like, I wasn't like an ogre before this.
Yeah.
I was very spiritual before this, but I wasn't, I had a like a reputation of being like, have you guys seen that movie Top Gun?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, Ice, the guy that's like, you know, I was kind of like Ice, really good pilot, but like, you just love to hate him. You know, I kind of let down that mask and let people really get to know me and became vulnerable. That was managing up. That was managing, you know, down. That was managing sideways. I just really became more vulnerable and very transparent with, you know, what I was trying to do and how I was trying to do it. And again, it's not always easy. I mean, there's times where there's, you know, incredible business demands and you got to try and find the best balance.
Yeah, I really admire your ability to, as you described it, you know, pull your mask down and show that more vulnerable. Yeah, I really admire your ability to, as you described it, you know, pull your mask down and show that more vulnerable side of yourself at work too. I think it can be really easy, at least for me. I want to put my guard up a little bit at work. Did you ever find that when you did that, you had any bad experiences or regretted it? you know, breaking into that more vulnerable side of you or opening up like that? Or has it been overall very positive for you throughout your career?
I can't say there's really been a time where I've regretted it. If somebody, you know, I guess takes advantage of that vulnerability, they're showing their weakness, in my opinion, not really, you know, showing that you're weak. And at the end of the day, you know, when I finally decided to leave Dell, I left Dell for two reasons. You know, one was a big part of manufacturing is something called lean. I'm sure you guys working in consulting, you're very familiar with it.
Yep.
Part of lean is something called value stream mapping. And I literally like value stream mapped my work weeks. I went and said every minute I spent, like what was value add versus not value add. And I was appalled when at the end of that analysis, I realized that I was like 80% non-value added time by my own definition and only like 20% value added.
Wow.
And I just said, you know, life is too short to spend this much time on things that I think are not value added. On top of that, I said, you know, I only want to hang out with people I want to be around. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying anything negative about Dell. I loved the people at Dell, but any big company, there are going to be people that you're going to be kind of forced to be spending time with that you probably don't want to be spending time with. And in my opinion, if you open up to somebody and they take advantage of that, like that's somebody you probably don't want to be spending time with.
So after leaving Dell, we know that you did end up founding LFM Capital, which is a private equity firm. What is the story of how you got there?
After I left Dell, I did 1 year as COO of a venture capital funded company. I had always thought that working in a startup would be the coolest thing in the world. Long story short, that wasn't a great fit for me. It wasn't it just wasn't really kind of how I'm wired.
Surprising, Steve, because I feel like what we've heard from you is that you like having no bureaucracy and you like, you know, kind of moving fast and getting to know these people, which feels like more like a startup. What was it that wasn't a good fit for you?
I would say my risk profile is geared towards something where there's going to like an 80% chance you're going to be successful, not a 20% chance you're going to be successful.
Right.
And had my first startup worked out fabulously, I probably would be a startup guy. But I've had two kind of major startup experiences. Both of those crashed and burned. And so I said, you know, I'd rather invest in companies where they've already figured out how to be cash flow positive.
Yeah.
And it's a matter of taking them from that level to a whole new level versus let's figure out, you know, does this business model even have legs? So, you know, if you think about my career, I went from the Navy, which is the largest organization in the world, to Dell, which was 18,000 people when I got there, 80 when I left, to about a 300-person startup, to a 10-person private equity firm. But I still would say I'm pretty risk averse. You know, I like guaranteed salary and all that, you know, of all those organizations. And so what happened when I was at that other firm was that through our fundraising, I was confidentially pulled aside by two major investors. And they said, look, we're not going to invest in your current firm. If you're ever the managing partner here, we would like to invest in a big way. Hmm. But we think we've seen this movie before. And if you leave down the road, we'd like to know about it and probably invest wherever you go. So I came back to the office. I told a colleague of mine about these conversations. He's like, you know, let's leave right now. This is like a once in a lifetime chance. You know, let's go found a new private equity firm. And I was like, no. I've got two kids that have been about to enter college. You know, no way am I taking that risk. And I had just completed fundraising for this other firm. And fundraising in private equity is typically really hard and painful. Hmm. It was literally harder than my plebe year at the Naval Academy, which is a high bar.
God.
Bottom line is kind of, I was trying to kind of work it out with that other private equity firm. And at the end of the day, the owner of that firm finally shared with me, you know, look, here's kind of, he was in his 60s. Here's kind of my long-term vision. You and my son will co-manage the firm when I retire. My son and I will own 80% of the firm. You'll own 20%, and we'll make all decisions by majority interest. And his son was like in his early 30s. And I was like, well, now you're just challenging my math skills. You know, like, that's just not going to be a good outcome for investors. It's not going to be a good outcome for me. So that's, I finally got the guts to leave when I was at my lawyer's house on a weekend. And lawyers in private equity are really expensive. Fortunately, early on, he had said, I want you to refinance your house, pull every penny of equity you can out of it. That way you'll at least have money to survive for like a year, you know, to support your family while you fundraise.
Yeah.
And so at his house, and I was saying, look, like, this is so risky. What if we can't raise a fund? I won't be able to pay you. My family could survive, but that doesn't include like paying the lawyers. I said, I'll go bankrupt, you know, and here I was like mid-40s, you know, going bankrupt's not really attractive.
Yeah.
And so he said, well, leave the room. Let me talk to the other lawyer and you come back when we're done. And so I came back in the room and he said, here's the deal. I have so much confidence that you are going to successfully raise a fund that if you don't, all of the work we're going to do for you is pro bono.
Wow.
And I was just like blown away. So finally, you know, that's when I was like they have more confidence in me than I have in me.
Yeah.
Let's give it a shot. I left my previous firm in May, and literally by like mid-July, our entire $110 million fund was already spoken for.
Wow. You know, early on in this conversation, you were describing how much you loved being an operator, right? You loved flying, you loved spending time on the manufacturing line, and now you've transitioned into this investing role. Was that a tough transition to make, and do you miss being an operator?
Well, I'm definitely still an operator. So when I look in the mirror, I still see an operator. a big part of what we're paid to do is select where to invest money. We've assembled, I think, a really good team that's very diverse, that tries to use the best processes possible to make those selections. But I would say LFM's key differentiator is our operators. To have a private equity firm that's run by an operator, I don't know of another one out there that's like that. And, you know, if you look about like the five most senior people in the firm, three of them are operators.
It strikes me that throughout your career, you've been really intentional about staying true to yourself in terms of the places that you've chosen to work, in terms of bringing that vulnerable side of yourself to work even. Are there tactics or things that you've done that have been really helpful for reflecting on what really matters? You know, is this job, does it mean a lot to me like it used to? Like, how do you actually do that day to day?
The tactic I use is at least an annual and a better situation, biannual decompression period. And so when I decided to leave Dell as an example, I've always been pretty good at vacations. I would say, if you graded me on vacations, I would get a beats expectations. I was on a 2-week vacation with my family in the British Virgin Islands. And, you know, I'm not going to lie, I don't completely unplug. But on this particular vacation, internet was pretty poor. And I was more unplugged than typical. And I just used that time to really sit back. I had just finished that value stream mapping exercise I talked about, where I literally had like put a pie chart together of where I was spending all my time.
Yeah.
And I just sat back and then I said, you know, Dell had decided basically to outsource manufacturing. And I said, you know, the company has gotten big and bureaucratic. They've outsourced what I'm really passionate about. I had successfully transitioned into a large P&L leadership role where I was running our phone consumer business with about 800 sales reps, which was really not, you know, common in at Dell at the time. So I think I could have stayed and had a successful career there, but I said, it's not what I'm passionate about. I'm really not passionate about the people, you know, that I'm working with. I'm not really passionate about the vision for the company. Why would I stay here? Mm-hmm. And I just think it's important, again, kind of back to that frog analogy, every company you work for, first of all, work is like a gas, you know, and you think about like when you learned about gas, solids, and liquids, a gas will fill any volume you give it. Work is like that. It will fill any volume you give it, and you have to be intentional about mm-hmm. controlling the amount of space that you give gas in your life. And secondly, I would say, you know, you spend more time at work than almost anything else other than sleep. And, you know, I think you have to really be thoughtful at least twice a year about, is this fulfilling for me? Is this, you know, do I want to spend another 5 years here? And if not, you know, what do I want to go do?
How do you think about defining a successful career for yourself? And do you think that you've achieved it yet?
So I don't really think about a successful career. I think about a successful life. And your career is just one element of that life. I have a good friend that's had a great, you know, career success, but he's been married 3 times. You know, and look, I'm not saying, I'm not pointing a finger, but for me, that would, I would view that as a major negative in kind of how I evaluated my life. You know, my priorities are, you know, God, my family, country, and then LFM Capital. And it's pretty clear, I think, to everyone that works to me, with me or for me or any, you know, that those are my priorities. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't say I've always gotten those right. And I think that, you know, I'm a huge fan of continuous improvement in every aspect of my life, whether that's as a parent, as a, you know, follower of Jesus, or, you know, as a leader of LFM Capital. And, you know, am I always moving, you know, in the right direction on all those dimensions? No. Unfortunately, with parenthood, you kind of get one shot to certain aspects of it. And there's definitely some things I think I've done really well and some things I'd love to go relive. But, you know, I think it's important as you evaluate success to ensure that you're thinking about success across all the dimensions that are really going to manage to you. It's so easy to become one dimensional in any aspect of your life. You know, physical fitness is another good example. That's really important to me. Mm-hmm. You know, I spend a lot of time dedicated to that. Now that takes away, you know, sometimes from time with my family or time from LFM. So it's all about trying to find the right balance. I think life is all about balance. And I think your balance changes throughout your career and throughout your seasons of life. My youngest is graduating high school in next week. He's going to go off, I think, to the Air Force Academy. And that's going to be a big change for my wife and I. Have absolutely just adored being parents. I will shed a lot of tears. I'll try and hide them for my son because it makes him incredibly uncomfortable when he's around. And he will tease me about it. But there will absolutely be, you know, parts of that that I'm mourning. I'll be exciting, you know, to watch my children get, my daughter's going to get married later this year. You know, that's just an exciting transition, but I will shed a lot of tears at her wedding because that's another biggie. I've been dreading that since the day she was born in some ways. But, you know, I think you just have to kind of meld your own kind of priorities with the season of life you're in and, you know, how you personally define success. You know, I love mentoring people and I've been a pretty active mentor throughout my career. You know, if somebody listens to the podcast and they think, gosh, I'd love to have a call with Steve Cook, you know, shoot me an email. I can't guarantee that I would accept every one of those, but the odds are pretty high that I'd at least set up a call and try and help out if I can. I think, you know, a big one of my sayings is kind of life is a group grope. We're all in this together. We're all dependent on each other. And I try and try and help other people as much as other people help me.
So one of the things that I think really struck me about Steve's story, and it's something that we've heard again and again through our episodes, is this idea of self-confidence and how getting confidence from others is so important. So we saw from Steve, like this confidence from the lawyers and even this self-confidence of proving someone wrong, like he was going to get into a military academy, is so important to being successful. And when I think about my own career, I want to think about who are the people that I can rely on or that I can be friends with that are going to push me and believe in me more than I believe in myself so that I can go be successful and be confident. Because that's where success comes from, when you're acting confidently.
I'm so glad you brought up the confidence part, because I feel like I'm always talking about it. So I love this switch up. I also was really struck by that. And I think what in particular struck me was that, you know, we always hear like it has to come from within. And we've heard that in some of our past conversations. But for Steve, it came from this external force, the lawyer that you just described. And so maybe, you know, it's not completely about how do I get confident, but also surrounding myself with people who will make me confident. And it's really about striking that balance.
Absolutely. I'm also struck by Steve's story with his transformation after this terrible tragedy mm-hmm. that happened to his family, and they were, you know, safe, but it really fundamentally changed the type of leader and manager he wanted to be. And I think he offered some antidotes to all of us. You know, hopefully none of us have to go through, you know, as dramatic of a crisis, but, you know, having an annual or biannual check-in of saying like, hey, am I doing everything right here? Am I spending too much time at work? Am I, being the type of person I want to be, rather than having a crisis force you to that situation is I think really wise advice.
Exactly. And I think in particular, I remember that analogy, he said that work is like gas and that it fills up whatever space that you give it. And I'm dealing with that right now. As you know, I'm juggling a few different things. And I feel like, you know, whether it's three things or 10 things or even just one thing, no matter what it is, it always seems that that work always just takes up more space than I want it to. And so how do you get really intentional about time boxing it? And is something that I'm actively thinking about. So I like thinking about it in terms of that analogy that Steve gave us.
Yeah, he had a lot of great analogies. One of the other ones that struck me was this real air versus fake air. And I think his frustration with bureaucracy and wanting to move quickly was, I think, something I also identify with too.
And that real and fake ties to his like idea of bringing his vulnerable self to work, right? Like that tornado afterwards, he became all one person in work and outside of work, brought that openness, brought that vulnerability. And I think that was really admirable and something that I hope that eventually I'm comfortable doing too.
Absolutely. I also think it was interesting he did this exercise. He obviously has taken operation courses very seriously, as that is his training. And he did this value added mapping for his own day and saying, you know, let's be honest here, like, where am I adding value? And that was actually how he decided that this wasn't a good fit for him anymore. And I think he didn't want to be in this fake air situation. He wanted to be the one actually adding value. And mm-hmm. I really admire that, because in my own life, I'm always frustrated when I'm on a project or working on something that it's fake air, doesn't matter, isn't important. And I want to be focused on the things that matter. So when you're, you know, every so often taking that time to actually think, what am I doing that's adding value here? And if it's not a lot, maybe it's time for a change.
You can find more episodes of How I Got Here wherever you listen to podcasts. If you like this episode, please consider sharing. It really helps. Do you know the perfect person for us to interview next? Or do you want to be on the podcast yourself? Check out our website at howigothherepodcast.com. We'll be back with more episodes soon.